So welcome to this bi-monthly conflict-free leadership call hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its Unbranded Doctor Project, which takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, affectionately known as PACME, under the PACME grant. I am Rachel Golia, facilitator for this call and a board member of the National Physicians Alliance. In my day job, I direct the Universal Healthcare Action Network. I think we've got a pretty good crowd on the call tonight. As of yesterday or maybe the day before, we had folks from about 21 different states, a good mix of physicians, faculty, students, med students from all around the country. So given how many people are on the line, I'm going to ask everybody to please mute your line by hitting star 6. Okay, I'm going to give you all a minute to do that. And later in the call, if people want to speak up when we have our Q&A, you can hit star 6 to unmute. Now, our speakers, don't mute your line. Okay? All right, great. Thank you, everybody. It'll be easier for everyone to hear that way. Okay, a little background on the PACME project. The grant is the result of a state attorney general settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. And partners for this grant include the National Physicians Alliance, the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and in medical research. And the partners on this grant promote a number of approaches to raise awareness on this issue and to build leadership in the medical profession to eventually eliminate some, if not all, conflicts. So for more information about NPA and the PACME grant, please visit the Unbranded Doctor website at npalliance.org/conflict-free. So our theme for tonight, covering and exposing pharmaceutical industry relationships with physicians and the drugs they prescribe. That is our topic tonight. And we have two terrific healthcare journalists as our guest speakers. Charlie Ornstein and Tracy Weber are both prize-winning reporters with ProPublica, an independent nonprofit newsroom which promotes investigative journalism in the public interest. They write for the Dollars for Docs project at ProPublica, among other things. And for those of you with online access right now, we suggest that you bring up the website because they're going to help walk us through it in the course of their remarks tonight. It's at www.propublica, ProPublica.org. So Charlie and Tracy have worked together for a number of years on several healthcare-related projects for which they have received national awards. And tonight they're going to talk to us about their work over the past 3 years, examining the relationships between drug makers and health professionals. As described in the bios you got with the announcement for this call, Tracy previously reported for the LA Times, the LA Herald Examiner, and the Orange County Register, and Charlie is board president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists and an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. So let me, before we get started, we asked them to speak, let me just say a word about how we're going to run the call. Tracy and Charlie will present jointly for the first half till around 9:30 or a little after, 9:30 Eastern time or a little after, and then we'll throw the floor open for questions and answers. And joining them at that point to respond to questions will be two of the partners for this project, for the PACME project, Marcia Hams, who is the director of the Prescription Access and Quality Project at Community Catalyst, as well as Dr. Steve Smith, who is Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine from Brown University. And Steve is also a founding NPA board member and Community Catalyst consultant on the PACME project. So they're two of our resident experts, and they'll be joining Tracy and Charlie in responding to questions. Before we move on to our presenters, I'd like to ask Ann Wallison, who is Education Director for NPA, to say a few words. Ann?
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight. I just wanted to remind people really quickly that this call is part of a series of calls and other resources being made available to the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, to physicians, medical students, and other interested parties in the effort to bring attention to conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry and to highlight policies to limit and reduce conflicts of interest at academic medical centers, medical schools, et cetera. And as Rachel mentioned, we hope that you'll visit the National Physicians Alliance website to listen to previous calls. This is the 11th out of a series of calls that have been offered over the course of the last year and a half, and also to view archived national grand rounds regarding this topic that are also at the are available on the National Physicians Alliance website at npalliance.org, conflict-free. And I also want to encourage you to visit some of our partners' websites, the American Medical Student Association's website, to learn about their work regarding their farm-free scorecard, which grades medical schools grades medical schools regarding their policies related to conflicts of interest, and also visit Community Catalysts. They have toolkits available that provide lots of information on strategies for reducing conflicts of interest at medical schools also. So I just wanted to thank you all for joining us and remind you that there's lots of tools out there related to the subject that we're going to talk about tonight. And I'll stop there and thank our speakers for joining us, and we'll just get started with their presentation.
If we've had any others join us since the beginning and you didn't hear me ask, please hit star 6 to mute your line to make sure everybody can hear. You can hit star 6 to unmute later in the call if you'd like to speak during the discussion. Also, we invite everyone, given how many people we have on the call tonight, we find that it works really well if people email your questions for our speakers as they occur to you. You don't have to wait till they're done. Email them to Ann, and she will sort through them and maybe group some of them, but make sure they all get asked. And if we don't have time to get to them all on the call tonight, we'll certainly make sure that our speakers get back to you afterwards. So Ann's email is ann.wolosn@npalliance.net. I'll say that one more time. ann.wolosn@npalliance.net. We invite you to email your questions or comments at any point during the call, and we'll make sure they get asked. So now I'm very pleased to welcome Charlie Ornstein and Tracy Weber to begin tonight's presentation on covering and exposing pharmaceutical industry relationships with health providers. Charlie and Tracy, take it away.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks, Ann. We're really, really excited to be with you tonight. We care profoundly about the issues of conflicts of interest in medicine and transparency as well, and we hope that we will begin a discussion. And before Tracy begins, I just wanted to encourage everyone on the call to please sort of continue this discussion even after this call, and so I wanted to give you our email addresses to do that. Mine is Charles. charles.ornstein, O-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, @propublica.org. And Tracy's is Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, .weber, W-E-B-E-R, @propublica.org. And then we're both also on Twitter and as is ProPublica, and we encourage you to, you know, continue the conversation that we begin this evening. So Tracy's going to kick it off by talking about dollars for docs, and then I'm going to come back and talk about our prescriber checkup tool.
Hi, everyone. So I know some of this stuff is going to be things that you already know, but I figure I'll give you sort of the background on why we decided to do Dollars for Docs. We had noticed that some pharmaceutical companies had begun to post who they pay for speaking and consulting and research and meals, but they made it extremely hard to look for doctors. And they have had, the drug companies have had to do this mostly as part of settlements with the federal government over whistleblower lawsuits involving, you know, improper marketing of their medications. So we decided that we wanted to scrape those websites of the drug companies and put them in one searchable, sortable database so that you could see, you know, who earned the most, or you could see whether or not a doctor earned money from several drug companies and what, how much money was involved in this and how many folks got meals and, you know, what kind of doctors were taking money for speaking and consulting. And so that's what we did. We went and we had some brilliant developer at Dollars for Docs was able to use different tools for each one of these websites, which they made it very difficult to do. And it was an amazing challenge for him. And we put it into this big database so that you could see, you know, search by doctor, by state, by company. And then you could click on the drugs, you could click on the company and see what drugs they made. And why we thought this was important was, we wanted to see how the doctors, the relationships between medical professionals and the drug companies and what that meant. And we were shocked to see the amount of money involved. And, you know, when we began to look at it, we decided to see who were these doctors, who were the highest paid doctors, and how were they chosen, and who were the doctors that and nurses and physician's assistants who the pharmaceutical companies picked to do their speaking around the country. And at first we matched all of the top speakers to the the state disciplinary records to see, you know, sort of just what kind of doctors. And we found a number of the doctors that were among the top speakers had records, disciplinary records for either, you know, medical malpractice or various other, you know, state disciplinary actions. But we also saw that in some cases, the people that were chosen, the physicians that were chosen as experts to go around the country and teach other doctors or at least use the slides of the drug companies to speak about them were not actually experts. They weren't associated with academic medical centers. They hadn't done a lot of research, or if they had done research, it was often with a drug company. You know, they were made experts by dint of being chosen as speakers. And the money involved was quite surprising. Some of the doctors in our first go-round, starting in 2009, had made, you know, upwards of $200,000. And in speaking with them, many of the doctors indicated that they were chosen because they were really great speakers and they had, you know, been chosen by their students as Teacher of the Year for speaking and such. And, you know, we would discuss with them, but weren't you using the slides provided by the drug company as is required? And they would indicate, of course, yes, that was true. But we also noted that, you know, as we were able to add more drug companies, the money really went quite high. And we have a doctor in there now that has made over $1 million speaking and consulting on behalf of a number of drug companies. What was also interesting is that many of the top speakers, if you were to look at them, also made money from drug companies that were not yet and have not yet revealed the money that they give out. So, you know, potentially many of these speakers are making, you know, quite a bit more money. And why we thought this was important is patients have a right, everyone has a right to know this information. And this was something that was sort of kept secret. Everyone suspected that it wasn't just that the sales reps were going around and delivering, you know, samples and tchotchkes and calendars and whatever, but that many doctors and other professionals were being paid to do speaking, and what did that speaking entail, and how did that impact their prescribing? And so what we thought was this was a valuable resource, that if you could look at this up and see that your doctor was getting money, did that impact his choice or her choice of a drug for you? Were you getting the drug that was the safest? Were you getting the drug that was the most cost effective? Were you getting the drug that was right for you? Or were you getting a drug that was, you know, needlessly expensive or exactly like the generic? And so it allowed an opening for patients. But also we found that since we've put this information up there, lots of doctors are looking at it themselves. They're looking at their communities. We have lots of patients looking at it. And as we started to look at the relationships further, we decided to take a look at a lot of academic medical centers have taken it upon themselves to have pretty strict conflict of interest policies. And many of those policies have been motivated by the medical students who are pushing for, you know, for their faculty not to be able to do promotional speaking. And what we found was really interesting there, that some of the universities around the country that had the stiffest conflict of interest policies, when we ran their faculty list against Dollars for Docs, many of their faculty were getting money for speaking and consulting in violation of the rules, and that the universities had relied on trust to say, or have their faculty say, you know, no, we're not doing this, when in fact that they were. And many universities are now using Dollars for Docs to run their faculty through to check now whether or not their faculty are indeed following by their policies. But, you know, a lot of these folks, a lot of these universities had policies that were basically based on trust. And what they found was maybe they needed to check it. And, you know, Stanford was held out as one of the toughest policies in the country. And they, you know, they learned that, in fact, many of their faculty were violating that. We also took a look at how the relationships between pharmaceutical companies impacted medical groups of medical professionals. And we took a look at one group, the Heart Rhythm Society, and, you know, just to take a look at the relationship and use one group, and saw a huge relationship between the group and its sponsors. And so that the medications that were most commonly used by these doctors, the companies that made them provided most of the money for the funding for the group. And how did that impact how the group's positions on their website, the group's advice to patients? You know, when you look at one of the meetings, virtually everything was paid for by the pharmaceutical companies. Many of the members of their committees had relationships with the pharmaceutical companies that made the drugs that that specialty used. How did that impact their positions? Were they putting positions on their websites that were reflective of the pharmaceutical companies? And we found that that was true. We also took a look at patient advocacy groups. And many of these groups are put forth as grassroots groups of patient advocates. And we looked at one, the American Pain Foundation, and found that it was started with seed money from a group that makes, you know, pain medications, and many of its biggest sponsors were groups that made pain medications, and many of the people that were in charge of the group had long-term and substantial relationships with the maker of pain medications. So we were able to, you know, we were looking at how these relationships developed and what impact that they would have on prescribing. And we, well, one thing we think is really important is how now that everything like this is becoming more transparent and you're able to look at how much money a doctor is getting, or a nurse or a nurse practitioner or a dentist, and you can see whether or not they're speaking on behalf of a drug company, how will they use that information? Starting next September, all drug and device companies under the Sunshine Act will have to provide this information. Well, hopefully they'll meet that deadline. And once that information is available, how will patients use it? How will physicians use it? How will that information be processed? You know, if a patient looks at this information, what do they get out of it? And we tried to put it into context on our website so that a patient can actually print out a form from our website and say, take it to their doctor, because oftentimes when a patient goes to their physician, they're, you know, don't know how to ask about stuff and feel a little uncomfortable asking their physician about this. But to ask, I see that you make this money from this company and I am getting a medication made by that company. That's a valid question to ask. And so if you look at our website and you're on there right now, I can sort of take you through what you can see here. Right now on our website, there's 15 drug companies that have currently made this information public, and it's now a total of $2 billion of payments in here, and there's 1 million payments, and these companies approximately are 40% of the pharmaceutical market. So if you go to projects.propublica.org/docdollars, or if you're on the ProPublica site, if you at the very top, you click on Dollars for Docs, you'll be able to see the site. And how we have it set up, you can either put in a physician's name or you can put in like Duke University. You can see an example there. You can put that in. You can put in a city. And you can also check on a state and see the number of payments from a state. You can look at different companies and see what they've disclosed. And if you click up, put in someone's name, you can see how much money they get from each company. And then you can click on each individual payment and sort of see the details of that payment. And we've along the, on the right side here, you can see the stories that we've written looking at who's in the data, you know, what kind of physicians they are. One thing we've had difficulty determining as we've updated this is whether or not transparency has made physicians cut back on their payments and cut back on speaking. Because the pharmaceutical industry uses more speakers when they're really pushing medication as part of their marketing plans. And if that medication goes off patent, oftentimes they cut way back. And we can see this ourselves because certain the top speakers will all be in one medical profession, and then that will dip as companies are pushing different medications. So it's been a little bit tougher to tell whether or not, you know, both the pharmaceutical companies are cutting back or physicians are cutting back. But when we got to the end of this project, one thing that we were really curious about is what sort of impact do these payments have on prescribing? Because this was a frustration with this. Sure, you can see that a physician has gotten $100,000 for speaking and consulting on behalf of a company, but you have no idea whether or not that has it translates directly into the physician prescribing more of the medications made by that company. And we got to thinking more generally, what do doctors prescribe and how, you know, how do, you know, who looks at that and what are the choices doctors make? And we had approached a company that collects this information and sells it to pharmaceutical companies and attempted to buy prescribing information to take a look at that. And even though this information is sold to the pharmaceutical companies, they would not sell it to us at any price. So we decided to look about getting this information that's public, and I'll turn it over to Charlie to talk about what happened next.
So we're thinking long and hard about what to do when IMS Health, which sells the information to the drug companies, said they wouldn't sell it to us at any price. And I think we ingeniously decided let's make a run at Medicare, because Medicare is available across the country. It enrolls more than 30 million seniors and the disabled. It pays for one out of every four prescriptions dispensed in the country. And it's a pretty good representative sample of the types of drugs that are being prescribed, especially to this population. So we put in a request with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for the information about the prescriptions for everybody in the program. And after about a year and a half of negotiations, they provided us with aggregate information. So this is not patient-level information, but instead provider-level information of what is prescribed within the Medicare Part D program. This is the outpatient drug program. And if you go to our website, to propublica.org/checkup, you can see what we did with it. We wanted to look for a few different things in this data. We wanted to look for physicians who were practicing differently than others in their same specialty and state. So people who were practicing, who were prescribing a drug that was their number one choice, but maybe, you know, for others in their specialty and state, the 47th choice. And why was that? Was this a drug that was particularly risky or inappropriate for seniors or the disabled? Was this a drug that was costly and heavily marketed by the pharmaceutical industry? Was this a drug that was addictive, or a drug that has been labeled by the American Geriatric Society to be inappropriate for seniors? So we began taking a look at this and did a big piece in May about the inappropriate prescribing from a health perspective. So not a financial perspective, but a health perspective, and found really eye-opening cases of a physician in Florida, for example, who prescribed thousands and thousands of antipsychotics to seniors in assisted living facilities. We found an example of a physician in Oklahoma who was prescribing a lot of Alzheimer's medications to young adults and those under 65 who had autism and other developmental disabilities. We were finding physicians all across the country who were prescribing thousands and thousands of the most addictive controlled narcotics who were just not being questioned at all, that Medicare had gathered this information but didn't share it with doctors, didn't share it with the public, and didn't even analyze it itself. So as we put together our site, we wanted to make this information available to people because we felt that it was not only important that you understood the relationships that your physician had with pharmaceutical companies, but also then had the ability to see if, in fact, the physician was prescribing drugs made by that company, and furthermore, whether even if the physician was not prescribing drugs made by that company, whether the physician was prescribing drugs that were perhaps dangerous for you or perhaps out of line with others in a specialty and state. The next thing we're looking at right now, which you'll be able to see in a number of weeks, is issues relating to cost effectiveness of prescribing. And this is something that's particularly exciting, and I'm not going to say a lot about it because it's our upcoming story, but I think you'll be able to see on our site a lot more information than you're even able to see right now about the cost effectiveness for each provider's prescribing and how that compares to others in their specialty and state. And we're particularly excited by some of the analyses that we did for that, which you can see when that story goes live later this month. And we update the data on our website, which right now is from 2010, Medicare Part D. We're going to be updating that with data from 2011 and Medicare Part D. And just a word about sort of how we do this. We spend a whole lot of time doing this. It takes us months and months and months, in the case of Dollars for Docs, to scrape the information from the pharmaceutical company's websites. It may come as a surprise to people on this call, or not a surprise, that the companies don't make it especially easy take the information from their site and to aggregate it, and we spent a whole lot of time thinking that through. Similarly, in dealing with the information from Medicare Part D, we were dealing with tens of millions of rows of data and having to figure out a way to bring order to it and present it in a way that was meaningful to users. And I wanted to make just one more note about a story we did where we began to combine the information from the Dollars for Docs data with the information from Prescriber Checkup. And that was a piece that Tracy and I did in June in conjunction with NPR. And that piece looked at some of the pharmaceutical industry's most advertised products, and we used a list of those most advertised products that a research company put together. And what we found was that for a drug like Bistalic, which is a beta blocker made by Forest Laboratories, that of the top 20 prescribers in Medicare of Bistalic, for which there are generic alternatives, not exact alternatives, but others in the same therapeutic class, 17 of the top 20 prescribers received speaking money from Forest Laboratories. One has since deceased, and two did not. So we found that at least when it came to this drug, but also when it came to other heavily advertised drugs, whether it was Advair, which is made by GlaxoSmithKline, or Exelon, those were similar drugs that many of the top prescribers were also well-paid speakers for those products. And so for us, while it wasn't a scientific sampling, it did raise questions that we thought were important. And as you're beginning to compile both the payment data and the prescribing data, you begin to get close to the Holy Grail. And as new drugs come on the market and you have real-time access to prescribing data and real-time access to payment data or with a very short time lag, you can indeed answer the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You can see if the payments came first or the prescribing came first. And that's something that until now no one has been able to do. So it's a particularly exciting area of transparency. We're committed to following this through and continuing to update our data. We welcome your ideas, your thoughts, your questions, your contributions in terms of ideas, story ideas, or particular areas of the country or particular drug types that we should look at. And I think with that, we are right on time to turn it over for questions.
All right. Wow. The work you guys are doing is really impressive and fascinating, and I'm sure you've provoked a lot of questions and comments here. Let me just repeat one more time the email for questions. Please send them to Ann Wolinson at ann.wolinson@npalliance.net. So, Ann, we've got some questions for Charlie and Tracy. Oh, and by the way, also Marsha and Steve, our resident experts for the PACME project, they're online here now, too.
Yep. Thanks very much, Charles and Lisa. That's really great. And perhaps what I'll do is I have a couple of questions. Maybe I'll start out with one and then see what the response is to that, but then also ask Marcia or Steve if they have anything that they want to add to what has already been said, as well as in response to this first question, which I think is a good one in terms of a broad brush. What is the reaction to your stories from physicians and others, and what do healthcare do healthcare consumers weigh in on your work, or have they in the past?
Well, I can take a first crack at it. I think Tracy probably has some thoughts as well. Healthcare consumers are unbelievably interested in this. You know, we are nearing about 7 million page views on the Dollars for Docs database, and we're well on track to pass a million page views on the prescriber checkup database. So people are really interested. And I think one of the things that our tools have done is take an issue which is abstract and sort of been relegated to the pages of medical journals in a very academic way, and made it very personal for people, because they can finally begin to answer the question of, does this apply to my doctor? And I think we've very often taken for granted the frustration that consumers have in reading something and reading a potential problem, but not knowing if it affects them. So we're gratified that people are using it. And Trace, do you want to address the other aspects in terms of how the feedback we've gotten?
Well, you know, what's been very interesting is, especially with the prescriber checkup, prescribers generally, and this is not a knock on them, they have no idea what they prescribe, right? So if you're a nurse practitioner or a physician, if someone asked you what's the breakdown of what you prescribe, you really probably have no idea. And then the reaction for physicians looking up themselves and their colleagues in prescriber checkup is pretty astonishing. One physician I talked to at a prominent hospital in Los Angeles, he became fascinated with it and, you know, was surprised by the breakdown of his own prescribing, but then was stopping his colleagues in the hall saying, what percentage of your prescribing is painkillers? And they would say, 3%, and he'd go, no, 7%. And everyone was sort of shocked and looking, and it made them rethink how they are prescribing, but they could also see how does their prescribing compare to everyone else in their specialty. Were they prescribing something that none of their peers did? They could look up a doctor they really admire and see how are they prescribing. But they could also make some connections. You know, if a doctor is prescribing, 90% brand names and categories that have really great generic options, is that something to think about? Or is a doctor, one of the physicians I spoke to in Florida was prescribing, 7,000 prescriptions for Seroquel a year. Well, that's pretty crazy that all of his patients would need the same medication. And it's been interesting for doctors to look at and then look at their peers. They're sort of very interested in that. But it also has been something that we've gotten interest from researchers, from law enforcement, from divorce lawyers. But, there's been a wide variety of people who have looked at both Dollars for Docs and prescriber checkup. And it allows, people to, employers look at, basically they do look at Dollars for Docs, and they're, asking us questions about when it will be updated. But it's also given a lot of thought for researchers. They can actually now sort of see some of this data, and especially the prescribing data has never been available, and it's really been interesting to see how patients can go and say, wow, my doctor's prescribing me this new drug. Does he have experience with this drug? Has he only prescribed it 10 times? Or I'd like to put my mother in this nursing home. Let's take a look at this doctor, and does he prescribe a lot of drugs that are dangerous for patients over 65, or a lot of antipsychotics for someone in a nursing home? And it's we've gotten a lot of good feedback on how valuable it's been for that.
All right. So, Marcia or Steve, do you want to weigh in here? I want to just explain to folks that we've asked Marcia and Steve to Marcia Hamm from Community Callus and Steve Smith to speak to some of the, they can speak to some of the resources and new tools available to help reduce conflicts of interest in academic medical centers and the medical profession. And we really hope that people will go away from this call not only with all the information that you're getting from our presenters, but also with ideas for how to act on it on what you've learned tonight, where you work or where you study. So, Marcia or Steve, did you want to weigh in here, or should we look for another question from Ann?
Well, if Marcia's not going to jump in, I'll jump in. This is Steve. First of all, I just want to thank and congratulate Charlie and Tracy on the absolutely superb work they're doing with ProPublica. I think it's absolutely great. And I just looked at myself on your prescriber profile and was happy to see that my top five drugs are all generic. So it's great to see that. One of the things that Marcia and I have been working on is
somebody needs to mute their line. I think we have a little interference back there. Star six, please. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Right. Yeah, one of the things that Marcia and I are working on right now is a toolkit on disclosure, because as wonderful as these public websites are, we know that only a relatively small number of consumers and patients are availing themselves of that information. So we're trying to think about ways that we can further empower our patients to get this information, and then also how to interpret it, because when you see that a physician has received X number of $1,000 for consulting from a drug company that, you're getting a drug from, is that a good thing or a bad thing, or how do you deal with that? And That I don't think we have a good answer for yet. And I'm wondering whether Charlie or Tracy have given any thought to that in terms of helping consumers, one, increase the number of consumers that access the website, and two, when they get there, how to interpret the data.
Sure. Well, the second part is really easy. As we've continued on different iterations of Dollars for Docs, we now, if you find your physician on there and you click on a payment, on the payment page, you see at the bottom an opportunity to see a checklist of questions to ask your doctor. And it's a printable checklist that also includes a QR code, which is a code that you could take a picture of on your phone, and it will take the doctor right to his page on Dollars for Docs. It includes links to information from the NIH about the drug, so to get sort of impartial information about the drugs, and questions they could consider asking their doctor if this was a concern for them. So we tried to make this in a checklist format in a way that's easy for consumers to use, and felt like that was one way of doing it. And as far as the other question, I think part of the problem here as far as more broadly disseminating it is we don't have all of the drug companies. And it also, drug companies do not use a consistent, unique identifier. And so we couldn't even be certain which, if a doctor named Jim Smith was you or was a different Jim Smith in the same town. And in some places, I think, Tracy, what, in New York there's
one doctor, there's seven doctors with the exact same name in New York City.
Going forward, under the Sunshine Act.
Go ahead. Was that Steve saying that?
No, it was me.
Sunshine
it was, so
oh,
going
Charlie.
Forward
okay,
under
go
the
ahead.
Sunshine Act, what you'll see is because the information is going to be released in a much more standardized format, what I expect is you will see an increased take-up of that information on physician rating sites and such, and so it will greatly increase the dissemination of the information to folks who are trying to get information on their physicians.
I do feel like there is a bit of a problem. So if you have a doctor that's getting 200,000 and you have a doctor that's getting 20,000, how do you make sense of that as anyone, as a journalist, as a physician, as a patient? Because, studies have shown that even little tchotchkes have an influential effect on a doctor's view of a pharmaceutical company. Also, there are some doctors in there that are getting, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of meals in a year. So much so that they almost have to be going out to dinner on a drug company's dime, several times a week or more. But they might not be getting speaking money. Does that equate? Is it the same? Those are questions I think that are really hard to answer. And, we sort of struggle with how much does it influence? Is $1,000 in speaking fees a year influence prescribing? And those are some questions that I think you get closer to with prescriber checkup when you can see, whether doctors are prescribing medication if they get money from the drug companies, and maybe we'll be more so after all of the drug and device companies have to publish this information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Anne, got another question for us? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Is that Marcia?
Yeah, I'll just add one thing, and, you know, these websites are terrific, and I think it will actually create interest in using the Sunshine website as well. And I think we had thought that, I'd hoped that the fact that CMS has the data and Medicare and Medicaid, and they will also have the data on payments, that they would be interested in doing this kind of analysis as well. But as you're saying, they haven't really made the data that you've made available around Medicare, prescribing in Medicare available, or don't appear to have done a lot of analysis themselves. So this is a huge contribution that's public, and hopefully we'll get them interested in making these kinds of analyses themselves, in terms of, because it has tremendous implications both for their patients, but for the cost of the program.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Anne. We got another question there?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting segue to this next question, which is a little long, but it's interesting. So I'm just going to read it verbatim instead of trying to summarize it. Any thoughts as to how we can convince CMS, and maybe it's not just CMS, but we'll just say CMS, to keep large long-term care facilities such as Omnicare or Pharmica from arranging with nursing home chains to use their pharmacist in these nursing homes? These pharmacists review each resident's charts monthly and make recommendations to their doctors for particular meds. Pharmacists are given a list of drugs they should recommend to the doctor based on kickbacks that they are getting from a pharmaceutical company such as Johnson & Johnson, which has settled for $2.2 billion with the Justice Department. Nursing home docs don't have much contact with the patients. I'm shortening this a little bit. And often go along with pharmacist recommendations. Until we break up this relationship, we cannot make much of a dent in overprescribing of antipsychotics or other unnecessary and potentially dangerous drugs to nursing home residents. Don't know if you have a comment on that. A new story, perhaps.
Yeah.
So, obviously, Omnicare and Pharmerica have gotten attention as far as kickbacks, and there are pending QI-TAM cases, which are federal whistleblower cases against them. There are settled whistleblower cases against them. As you know, Johnson & Johnson just yesterday, 2 days ago, agreed to pay $2.2 billion to settle allegations about its marketing of Risperdal and Natricor. I think that we can use this data to begin looking at how nursing home doctors prescribe, and then taking that back to where they prescribed and which pharmacy, long-term care pharmacies work at those facilities. I think it's more difficult to use this data to look and see whether a kickback was received, but I think you can look and see patterns of drug preferences and try to work back to see which long-term care pharmacies are responsible for the dispensing of prescriptions at the nursing homes at which the doctors work.
Okay. All right.
And just as a real quick follow-up to that, but it's probably not an answer to this. Has CMS decided to take any actions to address these so-called high flyers, the doctors who are the biggest prescribers, but who are also paid?
So CMS would not have any independent knowledge at this time whether or not the doctors who are the high prescribers in, say, Part D are also receiving money from pharmaceutical companies. You know, we've made those connections ourselves. And, you know, I have not heard of any plans by them to match up the data that they'll be getting from the pharmaceutical drug and device companies with their prescribing data. Charlie?
I'm not aware of any as well.
Okay. I do have a couple more. Has the industry tried to counter? Oh, go ahead, Marcia.
I'm sorry. This is Marcia. I just want to add one thing. I think that there are there may be opportunities for some action at the state level. You know, certainly Medicaid departments, for instance, have utilization review programs. Those are mandated in every state. And if there's interest on the part of advocates, and that includes physicians, medical students, journalists, organizations like Community Catalyst, that we're, if, you know, today we're working together to address some of these problems and looking to and talking with state Medicaid directors around ways in which they could monitor these kinds of practices in the nursing homes, for instance, where they're paying for patients in nursing homes, so that they could look at these kinds of patterns, these kinds of issues before they happen, rather than after the fact when there's a charge of fraud. So I think there are opportunities to do something, and certainly that should be true in Medicare as well. But that would take, obviously, since it's not happened so far, that would have to depend on an advocacy campaign to do something about it.
Okay.
I think you're right.
All right. Anne, what you got next for us?
Has the industry tried to counter or challenge your work?
You know, they have not. And the thing, I think that they feel that we've done quite a responsible job with, I mean, I don't think they're happy about it, but, you know, we've found mistakes on their sites and such and have alerted them. But I think that they, you know, they've made this information public. We've made it public in an easier format, and but we have done it in a way that is responsible, and we've taken care with it. We haven't had a lot of pushback saying they don't want us to do it or take it down.
Okay.
And you know, as a follow-up to what you just said regarding dollars for docs, how up to date is it, and how will it dovetail with the Physician Sunshine Act?
So we periodically update it. It is an immense, immense effort because companies, each of the companies' disclosures is different. It's in a different format. They change it regularly. They change the format on the website. They change. And so programmatically, we basically have somebody working full-time on our staff, you know, scraping the stuff and trying to work on it for website updates. The good news for us is that when the Sunshine Act kicks in and the disclosures begin next year, it has to be done in a way that is downloadable and sortable and analyzable. And so that will remove the scraping part of it for us and allow us to spend more time thinking about how to present it in a useful way and connect it with our prescribing data. But we simply can't keep it up to date every quarter when a different company is, you know, updating it from one quarter to the next and they're all on different schedules. It's impractical to do that. So I think our view is we try to keep it up to date, you know, update it once or maybe twice a year. And that's been our plan.
Also, one thing that our website will serve once the Sunshine Act comes in is that it will be the historical. So, you know, what's interesting is when you first put it up, you're looking at the, you know, the amounts from a year. But by the, you know, as the years mount up, you'll be able to sort of see patterns in it and track whether doctors have stopped doing it or, you know, if doctors in a certain area or a certain specialty, you know. So those are some things that you'll be able to take some more look at once, you know, there's more a more historical look at this data.
Okay. All right.
Hey, and then,
any more questions, Erin?
Yeah, I have a couple more, I'm not quite sure this is a question versus a comment, but maybe any of the four would have something to say about it. I'm really concerned about the marketing of biologic drugs like Humira, ABB, Vi, and Enbrel by Pfizer. They're not only incredibly expensive, but potentially very hazardous as they work by suppressing the immune system. They should be used only for patients with really severe disabling conditions, but they're being promoted for less and less serious symptoms. ABBVI is hard-selling Humira for psoriasis, virtually presenting it as a beauty product for people who are embarrassed about their skin. They're also running radio ads suggesting that people with nagging backache she asked her doctor if they might have, oh, I don't know how to even say this, ankylosing spondylitis, a condition that Humira is approved to treat. So I'm not quite sure how that, how this necessarily fits into your presentation tonight. However, I guess, you know, I don't want to speak for the person who's asking the question, but there may be some connection between some sort of conflicts of interest and overprescribing for not serious conditions. And I don't know if you have any comments about that.
I think it falls into the same category as pharmaceutical companies. And AbbVie, which is the company you mentioned, they do disclose their payments. And I believe Enbrel should be in prescriber checkup. So one could, you know, begin to, in fact, it is in prescriber checkup. One can see who the top prescribers of Enbrel are and whether or not they get funds from AbbVie and what are their specialties. And so that's the whole point of this, is to allow those sorts of comparisons.
Anybody else want to respond to that?
So we do have just a couple more minutes, and this is a question that just came in, which I would be particularly interested in hearing a little about. Do you see a change in the trend in how payments are labeled or described by the industry? For instance, are comparably sized payments to a doctor that used to be called speaker's fees, for example, still happening? But the fees are called something else, like research or consulting. Are you seeing any change in the way the reporting is happening?
So I think companies use their own language to describe these, and some describe it as expert-led forums, and others describe it as educational sessions. We sort of take their language and allow them to have that as an explanation, but we classify them in categories based on what they actually are, speaking, consulting, research. When the Sunshine Act kicks in, they have preset category titles, and so that will allow for greater consistency across companies. The other thing that's exciting about the Sunshine Act is that the companies will be required to disclose which drug the payment is involved with, or drugs, so you'll be able to see what the physician spoke about, what the physicians consulted about, if they received a meal, which drugs that involved. So that will allow you to do quite a bit of research and reporting around what are the most promoted drugs, and then going back to look at prescribing data.
Also, when we first started this, we were not always quite sure, like consulting sounds like it's consulting on a drug, but it's oftentimes consulting on the best way to market a drug. So for consumers or a patient, consulting sounds good. And even some patients we talked to said they believed their doctor was getting a lot of money. It meant that he was really an expert because he was getting a lot of speaking and consulting money. As far as research goes, that's an area that's really a mystery because, you know, it could be that a doctor is researching another use for a drug with the drug company. It could be that the doctor is, you know, so it's unclear. The research is a mystery. And if you look, some of the research payments are extraordinarily large. And that's something that would be explored. As well, a lot of the doctors that are among our top speakers do a lot of CME. And it's, you know, CME is another area where it's not always clear how the doctors were chosen for the CME. Were they chosen by pharmaceutical companies? How does that work for each different company?
This is Steve. I would imagine on the CME issue, and Marcia, jump in if you know as well, that if they're being reported in that way, that means it was a direct payment from the company to the doctor for speaking, which would be a non-accredited CME activity. Read that as marketing. If a doctor is involved in more real CME, the payment from the pharmaceutical company should not be directly to the doctor. So I would say any payments to doctors for ostensibly providing CME really should just raise a red flag.
Well, that's actually may not be the case one with PPSA. I don't know if it's true with the industry sites right now, but they will be reporting the names of physicians that are receiving payments through a third, let's say an academic medical institution gets grants for providing CME, if that money is directed through to two physicians or say through a fellowship, that will be reported. So it won't be necessarily non-accredited in the PPSA situation. One thing that I do want to mention before we're finished is that, you know, as you mentioned, Stanford and some other institutions were called out or looked themselves at which faculty members were actually taking money that and shouldn't have been under the policies of the institutions. And I just think that this is a treasure trove of information that if you are a physician in an institution or a medical student in an institution and you want to be thinking about, well, you know, are the policies, the written policies of the institution really being followed, implemented because you're seeing problems and you know, among faculty, this is a way to investigate that and to gather the information to bring to leadership to begin to make some changes in enforcement. So I think there can be some real progress made with some of these institutions with more active involvement of folks that work there.
All right. So, Anne, if we have one more quick question, we might have time.
Yeah, one more quick question. Has your data been useful in identifying possible conflicts of interest with members of P&T committee members or FDA advisory panelists?
Yeah, I mean, people have used our data for all manner of things, to look for both of, you know, examples in those situations, to look at, for examples of doctors who are quoted in pharma press releases, to research the backgrounds of doctors that they want to call for unbiased opinions, for stories they're doing about various topics. So any way that in which you can envision the data to be used to providing background and context about physicians, it's being used. And, you know, we encourage you to use it as well, to share it, to pass it around. And, in fact, you know, we would love to continue to have that conversation. And you know, I think it would be good at the end of the call, which I think is now, to give you guys our email addresses again, and we'd love to hear from you. Mine is charles.ornstein, O-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, at propublica.org, and Tracy's is Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, dot Weber, W-E-B-E-R, at propublica.org.
Great. Thank you, Charlie. I was just about to ask you to do that again. Yeah, Anne?
Yeah. And, well, I just want to just really quickly, Marcia has, and Steve from Community Catalyst, do you want to just give your, is there a simple website that you might want to direct people to in terms of some of the toolkits that you have regarding this issue that they might find interesting and useful?
Yeah, you can go on to the Community Catalyst website. It's www.communitycatalyst.org and look under a prescription reform section for the policy, the COI policy guide for medical schools and academic medical centers, and we have toolkits on gifts and meals, CME, curricula. There's seven there, and there'll be several more coming up. So please use those.
All right, great. And all this information will be in the written notes that'll be available on this call soon. And all the written notes from these calls as well as the audio is archived on the website at npalliance.org/conflict-free. So thank you very much, Charlie and Tracy. This has been really terrific, and Marcia and Steve. And thank you, everybody, for calling in tonight. Our next call will be in approximately 2 months, so please watch your email for the date and information. Again, for more information about MPA and this project, you can visit the MPA Unbranded Doctor website at npalliance.org/conflict-free. And for more information on the AMHSA Farm Free Scorecard, visit AMHSAScorecard.org. Anything else, Anne?
No, but thank you, both Charles and Tracy. We appreciate it very much. And thank you also to Steve and Marcia for joining us tonight.
All right.
You bet.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.